Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. On today's show, we're going to spend the hour with acclaimed environmentalist, activist, author, and educator, Bill McKibben. For decades, Bill has been a prominent voice at the forefront of climate justice activism. He's the founder of Third Act, which organizes people over the age of 60 for action on climate and justice. He also helped found 350.org, the first global grassroots climate campaign, which has organized protests on every continent, including Antarctica, for climate action. Bill played a leading role in launching the opposition to big oil pipeline projects like Keystone XL, as well as the fossil fuel divestment campaign, which has become the biggest anti-corporate campaign in history. In 1989, at the age of 29, he published The End of Nature, which has been called by many, quote, the first popular book about climate change. Now, since then, he has written 19 books, numerous articles for a number of publications, including The New Yorker and Rolling Stone. He serves as the Schumann and Distinguished Scholar in Environmental Studies at Middlebury College, as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And now he's back with another groundbreaking book. This one is called Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. And in the book, he argues that solar power isn't just a good option. It's actually our best hope for our planet. And note for listeners in the Bay Area, Bill McKibben will be in San Francisco on Monday, September 15th at 6 p.m. for a live event hosted by City Arts and Lectures. And you can find that information at kalw.org. Click on News and then our Your Call page, and you'll find out information about that live event. So Bill McKibben, without further ado, thank you so much for joining us on Your Call.
Well, Ethan, what a pleasure to be with you, and what a pleasure to be in the Bay, if only virtually.
Absolutely. Well, wonderful to have you here, and congratulations on yet another important book. And I wanted to start by just noting just what an incredible and precarious moment we're in. I mean, just thinking about, since you wrapped writing on the book apparently a number of months ago, there have already been a number of really devastating climate disasters, thinking about the deadly floods in Texas and Pakistan, to wildfires that have been sweeping across Europe. And then we've also seen these ongoing attacks on climate policy here in the United States with Trump's tax bill, regulatory attacks, firing of scientists, delisting of science from federal websites. What do you make of this present moment in the fight to try to slow the worst effects of climate change?
Well, you know, I got to keep writing the book right up through May, so I've been able to keep track of more or less what's going on. And it's such an odd moment for me, because there are any number of big bad things happening on this planet. Most importantly, as you say, the ongoing erosion of the planet's climate system, and with it, the suite of disasters that follow in train. But of course, in this country too, the quick erosion of our democracy, highlighted by all those attacks on science and on renewable energy. So in a world where there are a lot of big bad things going on, there's one big good thing going on, and that's the story I get to tell in this book. The super rapid, like over the last 36 months maybe, spread of solar energy, energy from the sun and wind, at not just the fastest growing energy on planet Earth, but the fastest growing energy sources in the history of planet Earth, a true revolution underway that won't come in time to stop global warming, though it may allow us to stop it short of the absolute worst, and that could, with a little bit of luck and forethought, also help diminish some of that grotesque inequality and concentrated power that's helping wreck our democracy.
Well, it's really an astonishing story that you lay out. And for anyone who is prone to climate despair, I would definitely recommend this book, because it's amazing how just recent the changes are. I mean, we're really looking at a hockey stick of progress, not the negative hockey stick of emissions. Can you talk about just where we are on solar deployment and why it's so exciting?
That's been what's been so interesting. You know, there was a little excerpt of this book in The New Yorker a few weeks ago. And what I heard from everyone, mostly people who've spent their lives in the climate and energy fights, was, I had no idea. I had no idea it was going this fast. And that's because it really is going fast. This is the story of the last little while. California actually provides us with a pretty good snapshot. It's not that California is doing everything right. And in fact, I think that California has made some very poor decisions about rooftop solar in the last little while. But there was enough momentum behind California's push for clean energy that it reached some kind of tipping point in the last year or so. Now, almost every day, California produces more than 100% of the electricity that it uses from renewable sources for long parts of the day. At night, as you know, batteries are now often the biggest source of supply to the grid, batteries that didn't exist like 3 years ago. And as a result, the bottom line is that the Golden State, fourth largest economy in the world, is using 40% less natural gas to produce electricity this year than they were 2 years ago. That's a big number in a big place in a short period of time. That's the kind of number that applied around the world begins to knock a tenth or two, three or four tenths of a degree off how hot the planet eventually gets. And it's not just California. I mean, Texas is now going faster than California with this stuff. And nothing that's happening in this country comes close to what's going on in China, which is over the last 2 or 3 years turning into the world's first, not petro state, but electro state. The Chinese in May were installing solar panels at the rate of 3 gigawatts a day. A gigawatt is the rough equivalent of a big coal-fired power plant. So they were putting up one of those out of solar panels every 8 hours. It's an astonishing transformation. If we speed it up and spread it around, then it's the first scalable thing in the 40 years that I've been working on the climate crisis that might actually make a significant dent. And as I say, it comes with other pleasures as well.
So it truly does feel like an energy revolution. And one of the things that you do so nicely in the book is lay out, you know, arguably about 1 million years of energy history and human beings starting with fire. Can you, without maybe going that far back,
yes, I won't. Give us a, I won't. I mean,
we won't go back to the campfires and cave people, but
the anthropologists just tell us that this is what that combustion has been what we've done for at least 1 million years. Darwin said that fire and language were what set us apart. And when we learned to control the combustion of coal and gas and oil, we called that the Industrial Revolution, and it produced modernity, everything around us. So all in all, combustion's been good for people, but it comes with serious drawbacks that are now overwhelming those benefits. The most obvious, of course, is the destruction of the planet's climate system. And when we talk about that, yes, we're talking about floods and fires, and, you know, it happens at such pace now that, you know, we're in danger of forgetting that it was just 6 months ago that the country's second largest city, large parts of it were burning down. All of that is real. Even more desperate is what's happening to basic fundamental systems. The jet stream and the Gulf Stream are now flickering and faltering as the temperature rises. And that carries with it the seeds of just unimaginable cost and destruction. In the midst of that, this other story appears almost simultaneously. You know, 1954 was when the solar cell was invented at Bell Labs in Edison, New Jersey, funded by millions of Americans dropping dimes in payphones back in the day. That invention was remarkable, but at first solar cells were so expensive that you could only use them on things like satellites. But steadily, steadily over time, that cost came down, a kind of combination of good activism pressing for more demand that resulted in cheaper manufacturing, until sometime earlier this decade, we crossed some invisible line where it became cheaper to make energy from the sun and the wind than from burning coal or gas or oil. And that's a epochal line for human civilization. I mean, it really offers us the promise of leaving off with combustion entirely and turning to the sun to get done what needs doing. We live on a planet where the cheapest way to produce power is to point a sheet of glass at the sun. That is nothing short of a transformative miracle, and one that, if we seized on it, might make enormous difference.
When you talk about in the book how traditionally renewable energy is labeled as alternative energy, when reality, based on what you just described, this is the cheapest form of energy, we should almost be referring to fossil fuels as the alternative energy. But if it's true that this is the cheapest, does that mean that our job is essentially done here? I mean, why would anyone be proposing a new fossil fuel power plant if solar is that cheap?
So even in a situation with perfect markets, we still would have a job to do, which is to speed up this transition. Absent climate change, we could just afford to let markets take their own course. But climate change is the biggest fact in the world, and it's happening in exactly the same moment and at an even faster pace than the rollout of renewable technology. I'll give you 1 month to concentrate on, June 2023, which was the month that scientists identified the sort of spike in temperatures, saying that all of a sudden temperatures in the air were higher than they'd been for at least the last 125,000 years. And every month since June of 2023 has been the hottest August, the second hottest May, whatever. We're still up in that spike. June of 2023 was also the first month when humans were putting up a gigawatt's worth of solar panels every day. So as in some Hollywood, you know, story, the race is on now, and it's not at all clear how it's going to come out, especially in this country, because here we're not letting the market do its thing. Here, the fossil fuel industry has used its cash to game our political system. You'll remember it was about this point last year when candidate Trump told oil executives that in return for $1 billion in donations, they could have anything they wanted. They raised about $500 million between donations and advertising and lobbying. And that turned out to be enough because they're getting everything on their wish list. The Trump administration is in a full-on effort to, well, you could say it several ways. They're in a full-on effort to destroy the clean energy economy in this country. They're in a full-on effort to speed up global warming. They're in a full-on effort to serve China our lunch. Remember, solar cells and lithium-ion batteries were invented in the U.S., but the way we're playing it now, the future is absolutely going to belong to China.
Well, we're speaking with acclaimed environmental activist, author, and educator Bill McKibben. He's out with another groundbreaking book called Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. And I challenge anyone reading it not to have the Beatles song, Here Comes the Sun, playing in your head while you're reading it. He argues that solar power isn't just a good option. It's our best hope for the planet. I want to go ahead and open the phone lines. This is Ethan Elkind. You're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. And the number to call to join the conversation, if you have questions for Bill about solar power, about what Republicans and fossil fuel interests are doing to try to stop solar power in this country, what kinds of policies we need to increase solar power deployment to meet the scale of the climate challenge. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And if you want to email any questions or comments, you can do so at yourcall@kalw.org. Well, Bill, you were talking about the fossil fuel interests, particularly in the United States, and with Trump mobilizing to try to stop clean energy. Can you talk about what happened with this repeal of the Inflation Reduction Act? It did really take place, solidify after the writing on the book stopped, although you hinted at what was to come. So what happened? What's at stake?
Yep. Well, you know, the Biden administration had done its best to try and start meeting China's advances here. That's what the money in the IRA was designed to do. But that was such a threat to the oil industry that they deployed their political capital and put the kibosh on it. So now we're going to have to work without that help. We're organizing right now for a big day of action that we're calling not Earth Day, but Sun Day. It'll happen on the 21st of September, the fall equinox. And one of the goals of that day is to drive home this notion, as you said, that this is no longer alternative energy. And in the process, to enact a series of policies that'll make it easier for us, even without that federal support, to do what needs doing. One of the big reasons that, say, rooftop solar is three times more expensive in the US than it is in Australia or the EU is the Byzantine and Baroque series of permits and licenses and inspections required to get this stuff on your roof. I just wrote a big piece for Mother Jones, and it included some focus on San Francisco area, which sounds like a fairly uniquely difficult place to deploy a lot of these technologies. We don't need that. We have automated permitting systems now at use in places across the country that allow us to speed up this process without any sacrifice in safety. This is safe technology anyway. If there were a, you know, endless host of solar panel rooftop fires across, say, Australia, where 40% of their homes have this technology, then you'd be hearing about it on Fox News or someplace. This shouldn't be a lot harder than putting in a new refrigerator, but we've made it very hard, and it's time to start going the other way.
And Bill, are you worried about the future of solar given the Inflation Reduction Act repeal, those credits? I mean, what do you think the impact is going to be?
Well, I'm worried some in this country, of course. It's going to slow it down. But the U.S. is only about 11% of emissions anymore around the world. And so I'm quite optimistic that not only will it not slow it down in the rest of the world, but it may actually speed it up some. President Trump has been trying to force countries to, as part of his tariff shakedown, to take more U.S. LNG, liquefied natural gas. And some countries, to avoid tariffs, are signing up to do some of that. But I think most of them are quickly calculating that in the very short run, they'd like their own energy supply, please. They don't have coal or gas or oil, but they have sun. And if the choice is between building out those solar and wind resources or depending on an erratic and fickle United States to provide the power that they need, I think Trump's making that choice easier all the time. So, it is very much a mixed bag. We need to do much better in this country. We can. That's why we're doing things like Sun Day. But we also are going to have to, I'm afraid, acknowledge the fact that we are falling behind the rest of the world. And there's one scenario where Trump is able to, you know, stay in power and keep carrying out these anti-scientific jihads, where we end up 15 years from now. I mean, maybe people will just come to visit America as a kind of colonial Williamsburg of the internal combustion engine to sort of see how it used to happen in the olden days on planet Earth.
Yes, like a Cuba with their old vehicles driving around,
exactly,
kind of a walled garden.
Exactly right. Perfect.
One of the ironies is that Texas, in some ways, is actually kind of a model, as you point out in the book, for solar deployment. Can you talk about what Texas might actually be doing right here on climate?
So Texas, to be clear, is doing a lot of things wrong. The biggest advantage that California has over Texas is that California moved aggressively on energy conservation and energy efficiency. So it actually needs a lot less energy per person than Texas. Texas, you know, no holds barred on anything. Demand is growing at leaps and bounds, but even faster is growing the sun, wind, and batteries to service it. That's ironic, of course, since Texas is also the headquarters of hydrocarbons for the world. But the fossil fuel industry tried during the last legislative session in Texas to slow down this transition. They had a whole series of laws, which somebody described as sort of DEI for natural gas. If you were going to put up 5 megawatts of solar, you were also going to have to put up 5 megawatts of natural gas power. But before they could pass it, people poured out of the hinterlands in Texas from very rural counties, people showing up in Austin to say, don't do this. Solar power is how we pay for our school system now. Wind energy is what keeps our old folks home afloat. And so the legislature adjourned without doing anything about this. It's not because they're progressive, as all Californians now know. The Texas legislature is hell-bent on electing Republicans at any cost, and you guys are going to have to figure out how to respond to that. But in these questions of energy, they finally just said, no mas, you know, just we can't stand up to these economics.
And what do you see as the future of solar technology here? I mean, have we sort of leveled out in terms of cost reductions, or are experts thinking that we're going to see continued decreases?
No, it continues astonishingly to go down. And in fact, there was a big paper today saying that the rate of decrease in the cost of solar is continuing to accelerate. This is a fundamentally different thing than the way we're used to thinking about energy. Coal and gas and oil are commodities. You go get some and burn them and go get some more. This is not as much a commodity as it is a technology. You build the solar panel, and then the sun delivers the energy for free, and we can get better and better and better and better at building those solar panels. It's funny, I was just out in my backyard looking at the solar panels in my yard, which are 25 years old. They were early vintage because, well, if I wasn't going to put them up, who was, you know? And they're still working fine at, you know, 90% or more of their efficiency. But sometime in the next 10 or 20 years, I'm going to have to take them down and replace them with new ones. And when I do, this really blew my mind as I was reporting it, Ethan. The materials in those solar panels from 25 years ago, once they're recycled and they're all easy to recycle, they'll be enough to build each solar panel to build 5, 6, 7 new solar panels. This gets cheaper because we get much better at using the silver and the other ingredients in those solar panels more efficiently. So this isn't just like a circular economy. This is like a Mobius strip economy. You know, we get better and better. The recycling rates allow us to, at a certain point, stop mining altogether and just renew and reuse what we've already built.
Well, we're speaking with acclaimed environmental activist, author, and educator Bill McKibben about his new book, Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. This is Ethan Elkind. You're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. We've got a lot more to cover with Bill in the second half of this show, so I hope you stick with us. We'll be back just after this short break. Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. We're podcasting the show. You can find out more information on our website at kalw.org. Click on news, and you'll see Your Call listed there, and you can listen to our past shows and find out what's coming up next. If you have a show idea for us, we'd love to hear from you. Drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We're speaking with author, activist Bill McKibben about his new book, Here Comes the Sun, and we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have for our guest, Bill McKibben? If you're an environmental activist or concerned about climate change and the future of the planet, what do you think needs to be done to help create the change and raise awareness about the climate crisis? Or if you work in the solar industry or have solar panels on your homes, or heat pumps or electric vehicles, all the technologies that we're going to ask Bill about in just a moment. What do you want to see happen? What changes have you seen in recent years? The number to call to join the conversation, again, is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Well, we have a caller, Greg in Palo Alto, dialing in. Greg, welcome to Your Calls One Planet series.
Hello. I hope I can string these thoughts together to make sense, because they're disparate. But I wanted to first make a comment about Mr. McKibben's statement, and I think he's right. The race is on, and that's exactly what it is, the race. During the past 3 or 4 years, instead of seeing a reversal of the trend of increasing emissions going into the atmosphere, there's been an increase every year. I have not looked checked the 2025 figures yet, but that's that's alarming, because if that continues to rise, then I'm not sure that everything done with solar energy, clean energy, is going to offset that. So I have a couple of questions. One, when or does he see when those emissions might start to go down? Second, another part of that is that even though emissions, I mean, like if on a dime we stopped emitting into the atmosphere, what we've already put up there is going to still have an effect on the climate. And I would like to see part of what goes on in Germany now. I think Germany has like this backyard solar thing. You don't have to put it on your roof, which makes sense. So I'm not as optimistic as he is, and I think that people shouldn't get scared, but I think people should be prepared for sort of increasing problems that we've been facing lately. You know, the fires, Absolutely. The droughts, the heat waves, et cetera.
Yeah, so no, Greg, excellent points. Let me let Bill weigh in on that. I think you raised
some
important questions.
Yes, absolutely. These are all very good points. And yes, no one should relax. This climate stuff is going to get worse before it gets better, if it ever gets better. 2 points. One is, he's correct. What has to happen is that the total amount of fossil fuel used has to come down, and come down sharply. That's why I was so happy by that California statistic that showed the 40% reduction in natural gas use over 2 years. We're now starting to see the same thing happen in China. They've put up so much renewable energy that it looks like carbon emissions have peaked and begun to fall in China, which is amazing because China is still growing fast in per capita terms. They use much less energy than we do, and yet they seem to be over the hump here. We're really going to find out, you know, in countries like India, which are further down this curve and really coming into and may be able to largely avoid huge fossil fuel use as they industrialize. India is just announced that they'd met their 2030 target of having half their electric supply capacity be from renewables. They'd met it 5 years ahead of schedule. So that's a good sign. But yeah, we've got to keep pushing hard. The good news is that as we use electricity, primary energy use should start to drop. An electric car is like 3 times more efficient than an internal combustion engine, simply because it's not producing waste heat in the same volumes. Most of the power is actually going to move the car forward. And the same with the heat pump, 3 to 5 times more efficient than the furnace it replaces. So as we move towards these things, we've got a chance here. But a chance is very different than a guarantee. It's going to take a lot of hard work, hence things like Sunday.
Absolutely. And I think your point about efficiency is really well taken. Heat pumps, solar panels, et cetera, not having all that waste heat from fossil fuels. But there's another key technology, Bill, that you talk about in the book that I think has really helped unlock a lot of the power of solar, which is otherwise intermittent. You know, it's when the sun is shining and not cloudy or not nighttime, and that's battery technologies. And we did get an email from Jeff, a listener, who writes, can you talk about some of the different energy storage technologies? It's not all lithium ion batteries.
That's exactly true. Battery technology is changing in very rapid ways, partly driven by the fact that, you know, things like lithium were expensive, although it turns out there's a lot of lithium on the planet and we're finding it quickly, including in places like the Salton Sea. But lots of other technologies are coming online. One of the most promising may turn out to be this new generation of sodium ion batteries. And sodium we're definitely not going to run out of. It's the, I think, seventh most common element in the world. And it, as you know, it makes up an awful lot of the seawater out there off the Pacific. We have plenty of sodium going forward. So it's good news that the Chinese are already marketing cars with sodium ion batteries. The ability to do remarkable things as this energy equation changes is just can't be understated. I tell in the book a recount going to an Oakland warehouse where a couple of young entrepreneurs were producing magnesium. Magnesium is the third most important structural metal after steel and aluminum. And the reason probably that we don't use more of it, it's very lightweight and useful, is because it has high energy cost to create. But it turns out that it doesn't mind at all if that energy is intermittent. You can run the temperature up and down in your smelter without the stuff crystallizing the way aluminum would do. So these guys were taking advantage of the fact that for a few hours, most afternoons in California, electricity is almost free at the moment because there's so much solar power. And that's when they were running their smelter. And they were using seawater to as the basis, not mined ore, as the basis for this magnesium. They were taking seawater and sunlight and creating structural metal. That's the kind of alchemy, the kind of transformative change that we're going to see more and more of in the years ahead.
It is very exciting for those who are, as I said at the beginning, somewhat prone to climate despair. There is a lot of innovation happening out there, although, as you point out, not quite fast enough. I want to welcome to the program another caller. We have Catherine dialing in from Bolinas out on the coast. Catherine, welcome to Your Calls One Planet series.
Oh, hi. Thank you, Mr. McKibben, for all that you've done. I just have a quick question. I don't hear that much about hydrogen. Could you compare solar and hydrogen, the pluses and minuses, please?
Sure. Yes, and I think you're going to hear even less about hydrogen going forward. There's the markets have a way of sort of sorting out technologies. Hydrogen is a kind of energy storage thing, and it's a way, its best use is taking sunlight or wind in a place where there's a lot of it, like, say, Australia, where many of the big green hydrogen plans have been announced, and transforming it into this fuel that you can ship and burn someplace. The problem for hydrogen, and it's not really a problem, it's just a fact of life, is that the cost of just directly producing power from sun and wind and then storing it in batteries has gotten so cheap that it undercuts the economics of this more complicated technology where you have to use electrolyzers and things in order to produce the hydrogen. So there's a lot less investment going into hydrogen than there was even a couple of years ago, but that shouldn't be taken as sad news. That should just be taken as vindication of the fact that the sun and the wind are capable of doing this job directly now that they have batteries to deal with the intermittency problem. And the good news is that we won't need to be developing hydrogen burning cars and things like that. EVs are going to do that trick directly. They're getting so much better so quickly, their range and storage capacity going up, their cost going down. And if you think that EVs are a nice technology, I'd argue that the single most transformative technology of our time is probably going to turn out to be the e-bike. We're selling far more of those than we are of EVs. And, the bicycle was an elegant technology to begin with, but now we've built what's in essence a bicycle without any hills. And that's a really transformative technology, mm-hmm. and one that I think will play out in all kinds of ways in the years ahead.
So you're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking to environmental activist, author, and educator Bill McKibben. He's the founder of Third Act, which organizes people over the age of 60 for action on climate and justice. So if you're a retiree or over 60 and want to get involved, check out Third Act. He also helped found 350.org and serves as the Schumann Distinguished Scholar in Environmental Studies at Middlebury College. We're talking about his new book, Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So do ring us up if you have questions for Bill, thoughts about solar policy, experiences with solar energy, either as a developer, if you have rooftop solar, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-TALK, or email yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email question from Daniel in Berkeley who asks, how much of this cheap solar power is the result of Chinese subsidies and exploitative labor practices?
As far as we can tell, not so much. The Chinese are paying pretty good wages, at least for China, in these industries. It's mostly the result of technological iteration. The Chinese thing really got going about 25 years ago when Germany, not a particularly sunny place, decided the Green Party held the balance of power in the German parliament, and they used that to exact a new policy called in German the Energiewende, the energy transition. And it allowed you to set up a solar panel on your rooftop and get a pretty high price from the government for the power you were producing. So Germans, through their taxes, were paying a pretty high price for solar power. That created enough demand that the Chinese started to get really good at manufacturing this stuff. And it's not just the solar panels that they're good at manufacturing. They're good now at building all the things that come with it. If you wanted the best, cheapest, highest performing cars in the world right now, you probably wouldn't bother going to Detroit anymore. You'd probably head straight to China, where $10,000 will buy you a really nice EV, and $30,000 will buy you cars that do things that American cars can't even conceive of at the moment. There's so much change happening there. And for any American patriot reflecting on the fact that the solar panel and the lithium battery were invented in this country, our willingness to just hand this future over to China should be maddening.
It really is a petro state now in the United States versus the electro state in China, as you described it. You touched on this, Bill, a little bit earlier, but a lot of people ask about the land use impacts of solar energy. Do we have enough space for the solar panels? And related to those impacts, the mining question, particularly for lithium ion batteries. And I know you talk about this at length in your book. Can you give us some of the highlights here in your response?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it's completely fascinating. And I didn't know the answers as I started reporting them. Let's talk first about mining, because it's really interesting. There is no free lunch, obviously. There are only more expensive and less expensive lunches. This one's a less expensive lunch, and by a lot. If you think about it for a minute, you realize why. You mine some lithium, you stick it in your battery, it sits there for 25 years doing its job. When the battery itself finally degrades, you can recycle the lithium out of it and start all over again. Coal's not like that. You mine some coal, you burn it, then you have to go mine some more coal tomorrow. That's why the Rocky Mountain Institute concluded last fall that all the mining you'd need for the battery transition between now and 2050 had a lower volume than the amount of coal we mined last year. Another way to think about it, if you want a kind of mental image, is that a shipload of solar panels coming across the ocean to the U.S. and then deployed will produce in its lifetime about 500 times as much energy as a shipload of coal. That really gives you a mental picture of the difference in these worlds. As for land use, that's the thing I think that stymies many people. They think, well, we don't want to give up farmland or something for this. Mark Jacobson at Stanford is the real authority here, and he's actually estimated that we'll take somewhat smaller footprint than oil and gas and coal do in a country like ours. But the real thing, I think, to understand is that that land is not wrecked in the process. In many ways, it's enhanced. Think about agricultural land. In this country, our biggest crop is corn, and half of that is turned into ethanol. We're basically growing gasoline with corn acting as a kind of solar collector. And an inefficient solar collector that you need to pour nitrogen and phosphorus on in order to make it grow, nitrogen and phosphorus that wash down the Mississippi and give us the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. By contrast, you can put solar panels on that land and A, it becomes far more efficient. I was in Illinois last summer with a guy who was transitioning his farm. He had taken an acre of corn used for ethanol, which grew enough gasoline to take his Ford F-150 pickup about 25,000 miles. Now that it was in solar panels, that same acre produced enough electricity to take his Ford F-150 Lightning, the EV version of the same truck, not 25,000 miles, but about 700,000 miles. That kind of increase in efficiency is amazing, especially when you consider that by no means was he using all his land. There are big rows between solar panels in order for them to work. And those rows turn out to be the place where we can do some of the most creative agriculture in the world today. That's because on an overheating planet, shade is a valuable commodity. It lowers temperature and it retains more moisture. Californians will be interested to learn that trials conducted over the last year in France found that yields from wine grapes were up about 60% by some varieties in solar fields. Here in Vermont, where I live, we're taking many of the solar farms and planting the rows between them with pollinator-friendly plantings that attract a huge increase in the number of pollinating native insects, up by orders of magnitude from what they were before. And so the farmers in the adjoining fields are reporting that fruit set in their orchards is up 30 or 40%. There are real possibilities for thinking so much more creatively about our rural landscape than the kind of monoculture industrial agriculture we've been pursuing.
So even if you don't care about climate action and solar, maybe you care about wine and grapes that can grow better under solar panels. Let's go to another caller. We have Peter dialing in from Florida. Welcome, Peter.
Hello. Yes. Here I'm thinking this is reminding me the Manhattan Project. Now, here's what I want to say. The Manhattan Project. If we really got serious and suddenly we said, wait a minute, we don't have time to kick this can down the road anymore. We need a Manhattan Project. Mr. McKibben, would you be in charge of it, like the Oppenheimer? And what would you do first? Now, what would you do first? It's like, I hear you've got so many ideas, you're involved with this, but if you had the power, you know, of like the Manhattan Project, what would you say, America, you got to do this?
Brother, the Manhattan Project in this case is already underway, and it's what's happening in China, where they are deploying this stuff so fast, it's almost unbelievable. And I think that we and the rest of the world are going to be taking a lot of our cues from them. But that doesn't mean that there's also not a lot of innovation happening in this country. We sort of tried to have something like a Manhattan Project under Biden. That's what this money in the Inflation Reduction Act was about. And that's what scared the oil industry so much that they lined up solidly behind Trump and gave us the wall of money that helped him win. So I think now in this country, what we really need is the only thing we can get for the moment are these changes in the regulations at the state and local level that will allow at least some version of the solar revolution to proceed here as well as in the rest of the world. That's what we're focusing on at Sunday. But you know what? It really needs needs, as much as the we have a lot of the technology now, a lot of the technological work has been done, what we need is this change in understanding. We've been calling it alternative energy for so long that that idea is locked into our brains. So I was saying earlier, it feels like we've talked about it like it's the Whole Foods of energy, nice but pricey. It's the Costco of energy, cheap, available in bulk, ready to go. If we could get those ideas through our heads, then the technology that's already available, we could use our political system to unleash, and in the process, save ourselves a lot of money.
We have an email question from Meredith Williams, who writes, could Mr. McKibben please speak to the challenge of keeping up with increased demand for energy to support adoption of AI, things like driverless cars? Has this been taken into account in his projections that we can meet our needs?
It has, and we can meet it. But the point is that what they're trying to do, you know, the president declared an energy emergency on day one because he said we needed lots of energy for data centers. Whether or not we need lots of energy for data centers is, you know, to someone else other than me will have to decide if they're worth it or not. But if we're going to do it, then the cheapest, quickest way to do it is with lots of renewable energy. But the same administration that declared this energy emergency took that off the board, said we're not going to be doing any sun or wind. And so now we're left with the worst of both worlds. We're going to see a big increase in demand, and we're going to try to meet it with expensive and slow gas and maybe even coal generation. That's insane. It's very clear that to the extent that we're going to build data centers, the way to build them is with sun and wind and batteries. And among other things, that allows us to move at something like the same pace that that industry is moving, unlike big power plants, which take forever to get built.
Mm-hmm. We have another email, and Eileen from Mountain View writes, how do you straddle the line between emergency and not scaring people? If you say hair on fire, people look around and say, everything looks fine to me. And if you don't, people say, this is something for future generations to do. So what's your approach on that, Bill?
Well, the best advice I've always ever been able to come up with is just be as honest with people as we can. We're in a very scary situation, and you know, Californians should recognize that more than almost anybody else. My parents came up in California, and they came up at a time when it seemed like the most idyllic place in the world. The whole rest of the world sort of turning to California as its ideal of, you know, what the world would be. But increasingly, you know, California is a kind of scary place. There's long periods of the year where you're looking over your shoulder to see what's going to catch on fire next. You know, the sea level rise is beginning to threaten the glory of the beaches. I just can't get over what happened in LA in January, the boyhood home of my first memories in Altadena, burned down on day two of the fire. So Californians should recognize what a moment that we live in, but Californians also get to recognize the possibility of this true technological transformation, because so much of it came out of California. And California has done so much to provide, at least in this country, a lot of the leadership. Mm-hmm. So this is the moment, neither for, I think, despair or wild-eyed optimism. It's the moment for some grit and for getting down to doing what we can do with what we have at hand. We've been given a tool, finally, to start digging ourselves out of the climate hole that we're in. We might as well start using it.
Well, let's talk about tools and activism. You've talked about Sunday, which is on a Sunday on September 21st, and I assume Earth, Wind, and Fire will be playing September in some fashion there. That's just too perfect. Although,
it's actually a really good point, man. A lot of this work on Sunday is about the beauty of this transition. And let's be clear, it is very beautiful to imagine a world that runs on something that's available everywhere to everyone. Think about how our geopolitics on this planet would have been different in the last 50 years if oil had not been valuable. Humans are good at fighting wars, but we're going to work hard to figure out how to fight one over sunshine, you know? So there's a lot of beauty here, and the music is a little part of it. I took my title, of course, straight from George Harrison. It turns out that's the most popular Beatles song of all time, at least if you go by the streaming data. And there's 500 more great songs about the sun, straight back to Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys and the Warmth of the Sun, or On the Sunny Side of the Street. I challenge you to find a comparable list of odes celebrating fracked gas, you know?
And so what are the long-term plans for the campaign? What do you want people to take away from Sunday?
Well, at, you know, at Third Act, where I've, this organization we've built over the last 3 years to organize old people like me, if you know anybody over 60, tell them about it. We're going to keep on with this organizing in the months to follow, and I think many others will too, following up at the state and local level to take the energy that we generate on Sunday and use it to affect change in statutes and laws of all kinds. And of course, that has to lead up into our big national elections next fall and 2 years hence, where we need to have people standing up for the idea that America deserves a future too.
Well, the book is called Here Comes the Sun. I recommend listeners pick it up. Bill McKibben, thank you so much for your work on this book, on this issue, and for talking about it here on Your Calls One Planet series.
Ethan, I couldn't have enjoyed it more. Many thanks to you and your whole crew for all your good work.
Thank you. And just a reminder, Bill will be in San Francisco on Monday, September 15th at 6 p.m. for a live event hosted by City Arts and Lectures. Check it out on KALW.org. Click on News and Your Call, and you'll find out that information there. That's our show. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. You can listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast. Just visit KALW.org. And you can follow us on social media, leave a review, and email any show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind. It's Your Call.